items.
Okay, Ms. Nagato will bring the meeting to order, Environment and Natural Resources Committee. And today we're going to be discussing forestry issues and further information about the Governor's Forestry Task Force. And today with us, starting things off, is Assistant Commissioner Brad Moore. Welcome to the committee, Assistant Commissioner, and if anybody has anything before we get started, we're not going to be doing approval of the minutes. We'll be taking minutes, and when we get to session, we'll approve all the minutes of special meetings, etc. So with that, Mr. Moore, please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Brad Moore. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for DNR. Appreciate the hearing today, Mr. Chair. As many of the members will recall, the governor's issued a task force and had a report in 2003 which talked about some of the issues facing the Minnesota's forest industry in terms of impeding its competitiveness. Since that time, there's been much work by not only the executive branch but the legislature as well on various pieces of legislation and funding to help improve the competitiveness of the industry. And I want to really give you the legislature a sincere appreciation because there are so many areas in legislation the past few years to really come through at helping make this industry competitive with other states and, of course, with other countries as well. Today we want to focus on, throughout this session, some of the final recommendations that are coming out of the task force in terms of areas that are going to continue to need more work in the coming months and years. And so we have a number of speakers before us today, and the part I'm going to focus on is outstanding timber price and supply issues that we have here in Minnesota. Well, first of all, to give you a context, the total wood harvest in Minnesota, here's a slide from 1995 to 2003, and what you'll see is that the total wood harvest has been fairly constant. It's remained much the same, and if you look at recent years, 2004, and what we're coming into the present year, it's much the same as well. And this is despite a growth in terms of the amount of wood being used in Minnesota. To give you a comparison for these numbers, the GEIS, which was completed back in 1994, had a low harvest scenario of Minnesota of 4 million cords per year, a medium harvest scenario of 4.9 and a high of 7. So the point of this slide is that we've never really even gotten to what the GEIS predicted as a low harvest scenario. And this next slide shows you the estimated volume of timber sold by ownership. A couple things to point out here is you'll see a dip in 2002 in sales off of our private lands. And private lands represent a real large, about 40% of the forest land in Minnesota. We think some of that drop was due to cutbacks in the private forest management programs, both by the DNR and by the industry itself. Now, it's upticked a little bit in 2003, but we're back also down in 2004. That's a concerning trend. We also think that some of the development and parcelization of private forest lands is starting to have an impact there as well. Public land harvesters remain fairly constant, and the industry harvest has remained constant as well. So here's another slide. What's happening is we have this constant harvest, but we're seeing our timber prices going up dramatically. And here's a graph of aspen stumpage prices going up between 1980 and 2004 from an average of just over a few dollars a cord to over $37 a cord. Some of you might know that anecdotal reports last year, we had some aspen prices over $80 per cord, and some even approaching $100. And so when you have cord prices going up this much, it really hurts the capability of the industry to remain competitive. Minnesota has some of the highest prices for wood in the world. And here's where I talked about the harvest being remaining the same. This is what's happening. Our imports of wood are increasing in Minnesota. If you look back in before 1999, imports and exports of wood were fairly similar or balanced. And in recent years, you've seen the imports move upwards to over 600,000 cords a year of wood that we're importing. Some mill surveys by MFI also suggest that this number is conservative, and we're actually importing even more wood, upwards of several hundred thousand more cords than this. And imports are not the low-cost place where to get wood, and nor are they the high cost. The concern about imports is whether we can maintain those in the future. For example, about 60 to 65% of our imports come from Canada. Canada is also working on putting in new mill capacity, for example, in Manitoba, because they want to capture the value added in their country, as opposed to exporting the logs here and having the value added in states like Minnesota or Wisconsin. The other imports are coming from primarily from Wisconsin and Michigan in the maple and aspen areas as well. So we see a trend where our harvest is relatively flat, our wood prices are going up substantially, and our imports are going up as well. So one of the challenges facing the industry is how to maintain our supply of wood. That is, how do we get that supply coming off the private lands to a greater extent, and also on a number of our public lands. For example, the harvest on federal lands has been dropping off in recent years, creating more pressure on agencies like the DNR and county governments to put more wood up. So these are all factors in terms of getting the fiber into the mill, having a good price for it, and ensuring that supply is sustainable, that is the import issue, for many years to come, that the DNR, with our partners at MFI and nonprofits and others, we're going to be looking at in the coming years and want to make sure you know this is a pretty serious strategic issue for the state. Before we move on to the next speaker on environmental review and permitting, are there any general questions on my overview about timber supply, price, and imports?
I just had a question. You said that Canada is expanding its mill capacity?
Yes.
And is any of that subsidized by the government, or is that in private industry?
Mm-hmm. I think there's a, Mr. Chairman, there's a lot of debate about how much of that is subsidized or not. For example, the timber prices those mills pay. There are other speakers, for example, the next speaker, Bob Anderson, who probably has a better understanding of that issue than I.
Thank you.
Representative Wilgenius.
Thank you. I'm having a little trouble understanding what outcome you want here. It seems to me you're lamenting average high prices received, and I wonder if those who are providing that wood feel the same way you do. That, I mean, it seems to me you're setting us up to want to drive down prices, and the folks who are producing that lumber, who have it now, do they say, feel the same way you do?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilgenius, you know, as a DNR, as a wood supplier, the high prices have been good for us in terms of putting more dollars into the school trust fund. The problem, however, and there are suppliers that are pleased with those prices, but the problem is if the industry is not sustained in Minnesota and those mills move away to other states, we run into a problem of then not having the value added here, and we export wood and jobs as well. In addition, when you look out west, you have a number of states that have fewer problems in terms of older timber and problems with fire, and they actually don't have the mill capacity anymore in which to utilize the wood. New Mexico, Arizona are two of those examples, and Colorado is moving that way as well. So then you have a situation where the federal government's coming in and spending millions of dollars on fire protection and wood treatments, whereas if you had a healthy industry there, you would not only have a strong job market as job creation, but you wouldn't be using those tax dollars that way. So in the short run, you're right. There's some great prices being paid, but we're concerned over the long run if it's maybe a short-term good supply now, but we're going to run into long-term problems.
Representative Wilgenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I mean, that's an interesting thing for you to speculate on, but without more evidence to back you up, that's a fairly hard thing to swallow, that high prices right now are not a good thing for our loggers and our folks who are providing that wood. So it seems to me if you want us to say oh, that's a bad thing, and we need to drive prices down. We have to see some real figures about what you speculate exactly what will happen and why. It's too soft just to say, oh, I think we're going to have a problem here.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, it's not speculation at all. There are mills in Minnesota that have delayed expansion plans on account of the wood prices. There are other mills that are in the stage of environmental review that are looking at this very issue. And it's quite a known fact across the industry. Minnesota has the highest prices in the world, and we stand to lose a great many jobs. Regarding the issue of whether, you know, we're lamenting the prices, much of the discussion over the next several speakers is going to talk about specifically some of the things that we want in order to maintain those prices and the wood supply. And the other thing about loggers and high prices is when there's a high price for wood, the loggers pay a high price for the stumpage. So the loggers aren't the ones that are making the money here. In fact, they're often the ones that are being squeezed some of the hardest right now.
Representative Dill.
Somebody?
Thank you, Chair Hepper. When Representative Portman asked the question, I wanted to just follow up on that question. Is someone going to come up and explain the relationship between the supply of wood and the cost in Minnesota versus in Ontario and how logging is done in Ontario? Because a lot of members probably don't understand that the U.S. government here in the Federal Forest Service land up in northern Minnesota is not being used anywhere near its potential for logging. But however, in Canada, their federal government or provincial government owns copious quantities of acres, and they sell it totally different. I think there's an important thing to be explained there. I'm trying to not explain it, but to tell you what I'm after. Because there's a lot of people that don't understand that Crown land is like immense compared to private land in Canada.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dill, I think as we go through the speakers, we can have them touch on that subject as well. Maybe as an entry into that, when you look, for example, at approximately the 3,000 cords of wood cut in Minnesota per year, when you look at growth of our forest, net growth is much higher in the neighborhood of 7 million cords. And so the point is that in our wood supply, we have the ability to harvest more wood than we are right now in a sustainable manner. But prices and supply are a very complex issue, and I think as we move through the various speakers today, by then we should have a better understanding of that. And where there are remaining questions, we also have a cadre of folks here in the audience that can speak to that very issue.
Okay, any other questions of Assistant Commissioner Moore? Otherwise, we'll move along and have our next speaker. Okay, thank you, Assistant Commissioner Brad Moore. And I think you want to bring up Bob Anderson in?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Good afternoon. Please state for the record your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bob Anderson. I'm a public affairs manager with Boise Cascade and International Falls and was a member of the governor's task force on the forest industry.
Welcome.
Thank you. If I just may comment in support of Assistant Commissioner Moore's information on the PowerPoint page that he spoke to on the price of aspen in Minnesota. You know, we've gone from some of the lowest price stumpage back in the 1980s, and during that period, that fueled the largest investment that our industry had seen in well over 50 years in the state of Minnesota. To today, where we have the distinction of having some of the highest priced wood in the world and an industry that is struggling. And please understand that we don't point our finger at the our Department of Natural Resources or their foresters, nor do we point at our county land commissioners and county foresters, because they have done excellent work these past few years to increase timber availability in Minnesota. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move to the a couple of other issues, the one being environmental review and permitting, and touch on that for a few minutes. I'm sure that you're all well aware that companies that own manufacturing operations in Minnesota consider the possibilities for expansion and new facilities within our state. They must do so in the context of the global marketplace. Within our companies, there is steep competition for capital dollars for these new improvements and new projects at our plants. And our sister mills in other states and other countries have very worthwhile projects, just as we do here in Minnesota. If a decision is made to go forward with a project, the question is always asked, how long will it take to secure the environmental permit, and what will be the cost? And as noted in the Governor's Task Force report, and I would like to quote, extended permitting and environmental review processes represent an additional and sometimes ongoing cost that further erodes competitiveness. And I would ask you to view the PowerPoint page here that shows the example, and maybe getting a little bit historical, but the process is taking longer than 2 years to secure a permit in Minnesota, where in the other locations, there's one other state shown here and several countries, that it was less than 24 months to secure a permit. Now, I want to make it clear, as we discuss this issue, that the companies in our industry are fully committed to protecting the air, the water, and the land resources of our state. The raw material that makes up our industry is Minnesota's great timber resource, and we must be good stewards so that the resource is sustained and the jobs and recreation that our grandchildren and future generations can enjoy. However, we have been long frustrated in the past by the length and complexity of the environmental review and permitting process in our state. Company decision makers are looking for certainty. They want to know what will be the time frame, what are the requirements, and what is the cost. And if the process is a black hole, then decision makers are going to be wary of entering that, and the jobs and economic growth will go to other states and competing countries. Through the work of the task force, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources have recognized this, that this issue needs to be addressed. And we commend the Pollution Control Agency for their internal review of the air and water permitting process. They use the Six Sigma quality management system to put forth some management tools and objectives designed to bring about a more predictable problem solving and timeliness in the process. Likewise, our Department of Natural Resources has begun putting together integrated teams for the permit reviews. And these teams encompass all of the aspects of their departments so that everyone's represented and working from the same page as they are working on these permits. And these improvements are certainly steps in the right direction. However, we're still faced with the Environmental Quality Board timelines, the difficulty of comparing the permitting processes with other states and other countries. And as noted in the task force report, and I'd like to quote one more item, and that's the permitting and environmental review processes applied in different jurisdictions around the world are fundamentally similar, but the regulatory framework that these permitting and environmental review processes are based on can vary substantially. We're also pleased that the legislature has also recognized the seriousness of this situation, and the last session included a provision in the appropriation bill requiring the Pollution Control Agency to study these differences between Minnesota and other key states and countries. And today we are awaiting their report and hope that this will provide another opportunity to improve the system here in Minnesota. Again, I want to make it very clear that we are not seeking to reduce environmental protection in Minnesota. We only desire a environmental review and permitting process that is predictable, timely, and cost-effective. I'd like to spend the remaining few minutes just on transportation, if I may, Mr. Chairman, and first begin by thanking you on behalf of our industry for the support we received in the 2004 session of the legislature. At that time, the change was enacted allowing an additional 10,000 pounds of raw material for a total of 90,000 pound loads that could be transported to our mills. This was very helpful. You will recall, in order for the truckers to carry that additional weight, they have to have a $300 a year annual permit, and the truck trailer must have a sixth axle. And this has worked very well, as more than 500 trucks have been permitted and now have that sixth axle installed. Next, I would like to share with you our industry's support of the Minnesota Department of Transportation's weight proposal for this year. And that proposal would extend the provisions of those 90,000 pound loads with six axles to all haulers. This provision would then allow finished goods manufactured at our plants to be moved the same as raw materials. And I draw your attention to the PowerPoint page here that 90,000 pound loads would have us on the same level as the state of Wisconsin. Such a change would be very beneficial to the sawmills and the oriented strand board plants, which are the smaller operations in our industry, because they ship nearly 100% of the finished product that they manufacture by truck and trailer to the marketplace. It would have a lesser impact on the paper mills in our industry because they generally only ship about 20 to 25% of their paper to the marketplace via the truck and trailer method. However, even there, it would be helpful because many of those truck shipments of paper are going here in Minnesota to the printers in the Twin Cities, St. Cloud, Duluth, and other printing centers in Minnesota. Now, this change would not be the end-all of shipping issues for the industry because the interstate system, I-35, I-94, still have an 80,000-pound load limit, and that's a federal issue that we must pursue. The last item I would just mention to you is to bring your attention to the fact that some of our mills face difficulty with rail service to their facility. And some of the mills, in doing so, are finding it near impossible and, in fact, sometimes impossible to get rail service, even though the railroad goes by the mill. They cannot get the railroad companies to service them. And if they do, many times the price of that rail shipment is quite unaffordable. That is the testimony that I have, Mr. Chairman, on behalf of the primary forest products industry. Thank you for your time today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Very good, Mr. Anderson. Any questions for Mr. Anderson? Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just kind of wondering if this rail accessibility problem is that because of the Canadian National, or is it other railroads as well?
Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, that includes a number of railroads and not just the Canadian National.
Anything else? Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Anderson.
Thank you.
Good job. Next, I believe we're going to have, let's see here, Bruce Zimbalin. I'm sorry. Please identify yourself for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. I'm Bruce Zimbalin, president of the Minnesota Forestry Association. As Minnesota's oldest conservation organization in the state, founded in 1876 to promote wise stewardship of forest lands, MFA's mission is to serve all woodland owners by promoting sustainability of all forest resources, particularly on Minnesota's family-owned forest lands. It was with that in mind that the MFA pulled together a number of interested stakeholders on sustainable management of Minnesota's forests in the legislative session of 2001 to discuss and reach agreement on provisions for the Sustainable Forest Incentives Act. The provisions of the SFIA were enacted to encourage the state's private forest landowners to make a long-term commitment to sustainable forest management. Starting last October and concluding last month, a work group representing a broad cross-section of public and private organizations concerned with sustainable forestry in Minnesota met monthly to discuss the SFIA. The primary motivation for this series of meetings is the relatively low rate of participation in the SFIA by family forest landowners in the face of growing development pressure on private forest land. The work group determined that the SFIA must be changed and improved in order to ensure that the Act's policy objectives are met. Those objectives include, one, ensuring a long-term supply of competitively priced wood fiber to sustain Minnesota's forest products industries and the jobs they provide, two, increasing the level of forest management on the state's family forests, and three, providing a framework within which Minnesotans can continue to enjoy access to the state's private forest lands. With these policy objectives in mind, the work group developed the following findings and recommendations. You should have a copy of a report if you want to follow it along as I talk about them. The work group found that substantial program changes are necessary in order for the SFI program to accomplish the public policy objectives of preventing conversion of forest land to development, promoting sustainable forest management practices on private forest land, and promoting public access to private forest land. Second, the work group finds that the current SFIA payment formula does not provide a large enough payment to attract a substantial number of family forest landowners to enroll their property in the program. The group also found that the program costs exceed program benefits for most family forest owners. Such costs include obtaining a management plan, submitting an application, preparing and recording a covenant on the land, and the annual recertification. The work group believes these requirements constitute a major barrier to participation given the perceived low level of the incentive payment provided by the program. Fourth, the work group finds that there are specific aspects of program administration that can be changed to ease enrollment in the program, particularly for family forest landowners. The work group also found that administration of the SFIA program would benefit from a more clearly designated lead agency responsible for coordination and promotion of the program. Sixth, the work group finds that the DNR and the Department of Revenue roles with respect to the administration of the SFIA needs to be clarified. And lastly, the work group found that information and data must be gathered to provide the framework for discussions to take place regarding the level of payment which would be necessary to substantially increase enrollment in the SFIA program. With those findings in place, we then went on to make a number of recommendations dealing with the administration of the program. And first, that the work group recommends that the Department of Natural Resources be the lead agency responsible for administering the SFIA program. Second, information to prospective enrollees regarding the SFIA program benefits and enrollment procedures need to be developed and marketed using both print and electronic media. Third, an educational and promotional program be developed to market the SFIA program to family forest landowners throughout the state. Specifically, it's recommended that funds for developing appropriate materials be sought through a proposal to the state's Forest Stewardship Committee. Fourth, a major promotional effort associated with the SAF should not be launched until such time as the program is modified, particularly with respect to the incentive payment formula. In order to avoid failing to meet the expectations of enrollees, which would permanently damage the program and compromise the state's ability to accomplish the policy objectives of the SFIA. We're also recommending some technical changes to be pursued in this next legislative session for the Department of Revenue to develop some changes to the Act that clarifies the payment eligibility when there is a change of claimant, clarifies reference to the forest management guidelines with which an enrollee must comply during the period of enrollment of their land in the program, and clarifies that enrollees of small tracts of forest land are afforded the same protection from liability as is currently afforded enrollees of large tracts of forest land. Regarding the incentive payment changes, the work group recommends that the amount and structure of the current SFI incentive payments need to be specifically explored. That includes evaluating a two-tiered SFIA payment structure for enrolled lands that provides a higher payment to landowners who provide public access to their forest land, and a multi-tiered SFI incentive payment that provides a higher incentive payment for forest lands which are in areas at higher risk for development. And with that, the group decided to do the following next steps and recommend its findings and recommendations to the governor's office, along with the commissioners of the Department of Natural Resources and the Department of Employee and Economic Development. And doing so, the work group requests that the governor's task force on global competitiveness of the primary forest products industry be asked to review the work group's report and identify needed changes to the SFIAA program to accomplish its major policy objectives. The work group also wanted to provide information to the House and Senate Policy and Finance Committees with jurisdiction over forestry matters, and I appreciate the opportunity of doing so today. And lastly, the work group recommends that a state appropriation of $50,000 be provided to the University of Minnesota's Department of Forest Resources to undertake a data gathering process to provide a basis for determining an alternative SFI payment structure. Now, with that, Mr. Chairman, that concludes what's in the report, and I'd be pleased to answer any questions that you have.
Very good. Any questions for Mr. Zambalin? Representative Pence.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this for anyone that wants to answer, and I could look it up, but somebody here I know knows. When was this statute passed? How long ago did we pass SFIA?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the Act was created and enacted in 2001. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Zambalin, when you enroll, when families enroll their land in forest lands in this, typically how long, what's the duration?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative, the Act requires them to take a place a covenant on the title for at least 8 years and have it recorded. They can opt out of the program after 4 years in the program, but there's another four-year period of time after that before they can be removed from the program.
President Pat.
And then a follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of your findings is encouraging or preventing, I guess, the conversion of forest land to development. That is a primarily a local, I assume a county or whatever jurisdiction controls the zoning of the land, of those forest lands. You're talking about conversion to development to some other use other than forest industry?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, well, yes, we're concerned about the conversion of these forest lands to both residences, any type of development that would remove it from a forest land base. And mostly it's with the escalating real estate prices and higher taxes in some locales, some landowners feel compelled that, well, basically forestry doesn't pay, and therefore I'll sell the property and have it subdivided and developed.
Thank you.
Representative Bill.
Thank you, Chair Hackbart. Is your organization just for individual type, or does Meriwether belong to your forest capital?
Which is Zambala.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dill, our membership is open to anyone with an interest in sustainable forest management. I do not believe Forest Capital Partners is a member of our organization, though we do have some corporations that are supporting members. Most of our members are private landowners like myself, 90%.
Representative Dill?
Well, we're talking about SFIA, and I was just wondering if you had a dog in the fight over the payment that they are not receiving for their SFIA land after Boise sold it to them. I understand there's like $1 million that wasn't paid to them. And one of my things about that is if we're going to have a program and land is enrolled and it has to be put on the title, the covenant has to be put on the title, it would seem that that would transfer to new owners. And if they're not going to get paid their $1 million, for the program, which they're still continuing to implement, it's going to more quickly lead to what you and Representative Cox were just discussing, fragmentation of the forest, because the landowners who were expecting that payment are now going to say, fine, we'll cut off the timber and sell it off for hunting shacks, and we'll have 40s instead of 160s, and we'll do exactly what you don't want to be done and what Representative Cox, I think, was suggesting that he doesn't want to be done either. So I'm just worried about that and thinking, wondering what your ideas were on that. And I know that's between Department of Revenue, and but that's a weakness in this system. And have you experienced when other people had land enrolled in the program and they sold the land, did the payments continue to the new owner? I guess that's really, if I'm going to ask a question, that's my question.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bill, that issue was discussed, but we didn't get into it. We are sympathetic to the plight of Forest Capital Partners, the Department of Revenue's decision. And with that, you'll see in the report, we did recommend a clarification in the statutes that would prevent that from happening again. As far as other landowners that have been denied payment when they've transferred ownership, I am aware of a number of cases where lands were transferred, but they happened to hit that window of opportunity for enrollment after July 1st. The law requires lands to be enrolled July 1st through September 30th. They closed their sales during that period of time of window, and so there was no problem for them to continue on in the program. In the case of Forest Capital Partners, I believe the sale took place in February, and when the annual recertification came up, well, then it was a change in ownership, and I can't get into the technical details, and you'd probably have to ask someone from the Department of Revenue why they made that decision.
Representative Dill?
Mr. Chairman, is Thomason here to testify?
He's going
to
be next.
Very good. We'll put him on a hot seat.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just learning a little bit about the program, you mentioned incentive payments. Are there other incentive tools? Does the program provide cost share or property tax reductions? Or is it just a payment on a per acre basis to the landowner?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, there is no other incentive. This is really an incentive payment. In fact, landowners who receive the incentive payment have to report it as income on their tax returns. It is not a rebate on their property taxes, as is the case, say, in Wisconsin, where you get a very low rate on your property taxes if it's enrolled in the managed forest law. Other than that, there's some feeling that lands enrolled under the SFIA would make good candidates for forest certification. That would sell, you know, make sort of a good housekeeping seal of approval for any wood that comes from the harvest on those lands. But there is no other incentives associated with it.
President Hanson.
Thank you. Did your group, when looking at how the program was working, maybe check with some other agencies and other programs that are similar? I have property where I have a wetland protection area where there's a covenant on my deed that goes, and it's similar where it has to be on there for 8 years, and if you change it, then there's a 4-year change. I think that program was passed about 2001, and it works with the local county auditor and also the Board of Water and Soil Resources. Did you look at other agencies when to see other models that may be out there that could be working?
Mr. Zimbal.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, we did. We looked at the state of Washington, Wisconsin, other places that had similar programs, and to be quite honest, the rollout of the program was somewhat muffed. Not to point fingers at anybody, but the Department of Revenue didn't receive any appropriation to administer the program, and as a result, there were some problems in the first stages of the program, lost applications, that sort of thing, that cast a cloud over the SFIA that we're trying to clear up, and Revenue has made quite a lot of strides in clearing up those problems.
Did you look with the Board of Water and Soil Resources on some of their programs that they're implementing?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, no, we did not.
Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good job. Okay, next we're going to go into the forestry forest certification, and we're going to have Mr. Bob Tomlinson. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Tomlinson. I'm the Assistant Division Director for the Division of Forestry and DNR. I'm pleased to be here and thank you for the opportunity. Before I start, Representative Dill, relative to your concern with the lack of the, I believe it's about $1 million payment, SFIA payment for a certain year, I think it was 2004, to Forest Capital Partners. Our commissioner did talk with the Commissioner of Revenue about that, as I think we've mentioned to you in previous conversations. And we basically agree that, if you look at it, that revenue is basically following the law that was laid out in 2004 relative to that. So short of some change in that law, I'm not sure what's going to happen with that problem, but we're encouraging Forest Capital to continue working with yourself and with folks over at Revenue to see that that is resolved, and we certainly want to see it resolved and hope that that will not accelerate any efforts, if you will, to be fragmenting the large land ownership up there, which is very important to all of us in the state, and especially concerning to us folks in the DNR, as well as yourself and others. So,
Representative Bill.
Thank you, Chair Hagbar. Ms. Donaldson, I didn't see you back there. Musilevich was hiding you, so I didn't see you back in the crowd. Anyway, so at this time, you don't know of any proposed bill that is coming forward to fix this problem.
Ms. Donaldson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, I am not aware of any bills to fix that problem. As Bruce Sumballin mentioned, one of their recommendations in the report, though, would be to prevent the problem from occurring in the future. I realize that doesn't do much for Forest Capital for 2004, but...
Okay. Thank you. Please proceed with the question.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let's see here. I need to do this up. Whoops. First off, I would like to acknowledge the presence of a couple people here. Andrew Ahrens is on the DNR Division of Forestry staff, sitting behind me here, and he's probably the person that's been most responsible for us attaining third-party certification on DNR public forest lands over the last year and a half. He's been the guy, the go-to guy, the point person for this within the department, and it really deserves a lot of the credit for us accomplishing what we've been able to do in a short time. And the other person I want to mention is that Bruce Cox is also here. He's a Clearwater County Land Commissioner and is here representing the counties as well as the Society of American Foresters today. And if there's any questions that come up that pertain specific thoughts on the certification, I'll probably ask one of those two folks that have much more expertise in this than myself to come forward and try and respond.
That'd be fine. We'll try to hold questions until you're done with your presentation.
Thank you. One of the key recommendations from the Governor's Task Force report, of course, was to obtain third-party certification for all forest lands in the state. I'm going to speak for certification efforts on state and county public forest lands. And following me, Dr. Robert Stein will be speaking on the certification efforts relative to the private lands. A couple of general comments. One example, of a primary consumer catalyst behind this whole effort was Time Warner, who buys a lot of paper products in Minnesota. From Minnesota Forest Industries, and they set a goal for themselves and for their producers of those products that 80% of the pulp that they use in their processing of their products has to be from certified forests by January of 06. This, of course, isn't the only reason, but it was one of the
reasons why we accelerated efforts, I think, and really moved forward with this as quickly as we did. FSC is the Forest Stewardship Council and SFI Sustainable Forestry Initiative are the two certification standards by which the DNR chose to go with. In addition, there's SCS, which is Scientific Certification Systems. They're the third-party auditor that we hire to actually go out and audit our practices against the FSC and SFI standards. DNR went with both of these certifiers because together they are considered, as we like to refer to it, as the gold standard, if you will, in certification, especially for large public land managers. As I mentioned, we were evaluated against their standards, which consisted of over 160, if you count them up at a very coarse level, standards or criteria that we were looked at in our operations in the DNR. Why did we do this and the value that it brought to us? It's reaffirmed, number one, that we're largely practicing environmentally sound, sustainable forest management, and we hope that this will translate into continued support for our programs and processes that we are engaged on state public lands. It has also helped us to establish a more comprehensive and continuous improvement process within DNR. And finally, and probably the most significant, at least at this point in time, is that it economically it will help to maintain and enhance Minnesota's place in an increasingly competitive global marketplace. The scope of the effort has been considerable over the last year and a half or so. Almost 1 million acres of wildlife management area that are forested or partly forested was included in the effort, and another 3.8 million acres of state forest land for a total of about 4.8 million acres of state forest land in Minnesota. We did not pursue certification on state parks, scientific and natural areas, or any wildlife areas or other lands in the Prairie Province of Minnesota at this past time. I want to acknowledge that the fact that we did receive $250,000 from LCMR, which was greatly appreciated for this effort. It did pay for the initial audit, and it will help to pay for an annual audit over the next few years as we go forth in this continuous process. In summary, it suggests that we've met a very ambitious goal set out by the Governor's Task Force report, which was to become certified by January of 2006. And this is the largest certification effort awarded in the United States. What's next? Achieving forest certification is only the first step. Subsequent steps will include annual surveillance audits, every 5 years, a complete re-audit, follow-up on continuous improvement efforts, and including the follow-up on 19 corrective action requests, which came to us through the audit. An example of one of those corrective action requests was that we need to demonstrate that we can prove that our operators on timber sales on state forest lands have the right amounts of liability insurance, workers' compensation coverage, and environmental training for their loggers. We need to show proof of these on all sales, and as a matter of fact, legislation that will be coming before your committee as part of our forest policy bill this year will include elements of all of those three that will be within the current state laws and processes. So you'll be hearing more about those and the reasons for those as we get into the policy bill deliberations later in the session. Uh,
the county's accomplishments towards certification, there is about 2.5 million acres of county managed forest land in the state. Aiken County has about 200,000 or plus acres of that. They have been certified under FSC certification for about 7 years already. Six additional counties are currently working on certification. Those are listed in slide 16 on page 6 of your handout. They're working towards certification. To meet the requirements, the counties need to ensure that their existing forest management practices meet the requirements of the standards of FSC or SFI, or the combination of them, whichever they choose to go with. The county land department staffs are currently working together to review and critique their existing practices and cooperatively develop the procedures, processes, and infrastructure to improve those practices. And that will result in more formalized procedures, improved business practices, and other things that will help them meet the auditor's needs once they embark on the certification shortly. That's all I have on state land and county land. And if you care, I can take a few questions now on what I presented, or we can go to the next set of slides of the private lands, and however you prefer to do it.
Director Thomas, I think we have a few questions. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Assistant Director Tomlinson, you mentioned that you certified WMAs. Are we logging on WMAs?
Tomlinson.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, that's correct. Those WMAs that have forest on them are managed. They're managed for different purposes, perhaps, than state forests. But yes, there is logging on WMAs.
Representative McNamara.
Oh, okay, and Director Tomlinson, Assistant Director, I better not give you a promotion here yet.
Thank you.
So, good to see you again. In the logging, then, we are managing them similarly to state forests that you did said we're doing some reforestation after the logging and doing an active job. I'm glad to hear. I didn't realize you caught Representative Dill and I both off guard. Neither one of us knew that we are that progressive of thought. Thinkers, or I can't even talk right. It's been a long two way from here, 2 o'clock. So that is good that you are doing some logging there. And is it as active as we do on our state forest plan?
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, we're very active. We've worked with the Division of Wildlife for years in helping not only log but assure reforestation or establishment of permanent open areas on wildlife areas and those sorts of things. So, like I say, their objectives, depending on what types of wildlife species they're managing for, might be a bit different than what our objectives might be with it. But I think the important thing is that just like logging is important and good for state forest lands for healthy, resilient, and diversity within state forests, it's equally as good for that on wildlife management areas, and I think they recognize that. We work closely with them on that.
Very quickly, thank you, Mr. Chair. You answered kind of what I was hoping, so that we're letting the popple grow in the WMA so we have more deer instead of planting pine trees. That's what I got out of that, and I hope to an extent anyway, as you and I have had long discussions, that we should be thinking of the hundreds of thousands of deer hunters we have in this state at times. Thank you.
Representative Gaines.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You were talking about the gold standard for certification, and I wondered within that gold standard, are there requirements for how you deal with invasive species?
Mr. Chair, I'd like Andrew Harris to respond to Representative Gaines on that.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Andrew Aarons, Department of Natural Resources.
Can you hear the question?
Yes, I did. Thank
Please proceed.
Yes, there are provisions about controlling exotic invasive species. In fact, the DNR has several programs, aquatic and terrestrial programs, to deal with exotic species, and we will continue those efforts.
Representative Guinness?
Well, then perhaps it's important that we understand what you're calling exotic or alien. How about reed canary grass? Is that something you're controlling or you consider exotic?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, reed canary grass is typically found more in the prairie areas of the state, but as far as what exotic species, they are non-native species to Minnesota. But yes, reed canary grass would be a non-native, but not directly impacting forest certification.
Representative Gaines?
That's what I need to understand when you say not directly impacting forest certification. When we were visiting up in Cloquet and other forests up along the north, one was LCMR, the thing that I noticed the most was reed canary grass. It was all over the place. And we saw a forest that had been cleared now. The canopy is gone, and we're looking at the seedlings coming up and bordering the whole thing was reed canary grass. And so it was my expectation that now the forest cover was gone, that reed canary grass would just go marching in. And it was a very troubling sight because I was seeing it all over the place. So when you say that it's a problem in the prairies, I don't think so. My observation was it was just all. I was just stunned how much there was. So my question is, what management are we requiring with regard to exotics like reed canary grass?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, your point is well taken. I've worked in the southern part of the state, and that typically is more of a prairie problem. As far as it being in the northern forest, I'm not aware of that. But if you saw it, then it was there. Reed canary grass is a tough species to deal with because it seeds prevalently. The seed hangs on in the soil for a long time. You have limited options. Burning tends to increase reed canary grass. So it's one of those things that the DNR has to do more research, look a little more in depth as how to control that. So I can't give you an answer right off the cuff how we would deal with reed canary grass.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was wondering how, I want to make sure our gold standard isn't a tarnished gold standard, and reed canary grass, if we are supposed to manage for aliens, this is a big one. So it feels to me like we need to talk about that issue and how we're going to deal with it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, some of the other species would be leafy spurge,
right.
Gypsy moth, some of the other things. Buckthorn is a big problem.
Right.
And we've got a whole list of species that we need to worry about. So thank you for that input.
The thing is that I think people generally know that leafy spurge is bad news, and we have beetles that can deal with leafy spurge. But it is my understanding that we're still allowing the sale of reed canary grass seed in this state. Am I right about that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I couldn't speak to that. It's possible.
If you could get that information for us, if that sale is still allowed, and if we are really trying to protect our forests.
Ms. Thomas?
Well, Mr. Chair, to Representative Gaines' point, too, I want to emphasize that this is a continuous improvement process. If the issue that you just brought up is still an issue a year from now, it will be reaffirmed with us at that point, and we'll be expected to do something about that. It's not that we've accomplished this certification, now we just go on and do things the way we've done them, but we're expected to follow through with the recommendations in the report. The auditors aren't going to pick up everything the first time through. They will come back yearly, and they'll do the next big re-audit, I guess you call it, in 5 years, and look at a lot more things. But it's just so that we will continuously improve and go through that process. And so just wanted to emphasize that.
Representative McGinnis.
Thank you. Nonetheless, that red canary grass is out there, and I think we need to understand, one, do we still allow the sale of red canary grass seed in Minnesota? And if we do, what are we going to do about it? And do we make part of our management plan managing for this particular alien? So those are the two things I'd like to understand. And I have asked DNR folks before on this, and I haven't gotten much feedback, which concerns me.
Sure. Mr. Chair, we noted those 2 points, and we would respond to the committee.
Very good. That would be great. Thank you very much. Any further questions for Assistant Director? Representative Blaine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and if this has been covered before, I apologize, but Mr. Tomlinson, I had a couple questions about when you talked before about reforestation on state land, and I got a couple of questions as far as the availability of funding for reforestation. And then how do we determine, or how does the DNR determine where that money is spent on state lands? Do they rank it, or is it due to however much timber is harvested, or if you could maybe help us there a little bit on that issue?
Good comments.
Certainly. I think the first thing to keep in mind is that we annually harvest, and this is just general figures, but generally speaking, we harvest about 35,000 acres every year off of state forest lands. 10 to 12,000 acres of that is artificially regenerated, either tree planting or seeding. The balance of it goes back mostly into aspen, as Representative McNamara likes to see for all those deer out there. But we 10 to 12,000 acres into that. We then, that costs us a base amount of about $2 million. That, coincidentally, is reflected in this year's governor's recommendation relative to the reforestation bonding request for the division. $4 million for a two-year period for 10 to 12,000 each year of reforestation. The second part of your question was, how do we prioritize that? That's all identified by the foresters even before the sites are harvested. They go out and identify what the desired future condition of that site might be, whether or not it's aspen that should be stayed in aspen. We don't do anything with it then other than harvest it at certain times of the year and those sorts of things. But more importantly, we look for opportunities, if you will, for establishing some of those longer-lived conifer species. In other words, we have an information system, if you will, that our foresters plug all that information into, and that generates annually a list for us all throughout the state about how where that 10 to 12,000 acres are divvied up around the state. And we just start and get through that as much as we can with the $2 million or so that we'll put for that on an annual basis. Does that help answer your question relative to how we prioritize it?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Tomlinson, yes. I'm wondering, though, if we are looking positively at the $4 million coming through from the governor's recommendations on reforestation, and you had stated that, or at least in my understanding of what you had stated, is that the Forestry Division of DNR is basically would already have recommendations where that money would go for forestation in the next few years, and basically where that money will get spent. And I'm just wondering if I could get a copy of that list to see where that money is going, if that would be possible.
Absolutely. We'll provide you with a copy of that.
Very good. Representative Dennis, did you have your hand up before?
No, I didn't.
Okay. Representative Gies. Then we're going to have to move on. This is the last question we'll have on this issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When I was thinking about corrective actions, I only asked one of my two questions, and the other is with regard to altering vehicles. Understand you have corrective actions requests there, and my question is, what are you going to do to meet those corrective action requests?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's a very good question. We did receive two corrective action requests dealing with all-terrain vehicles, off-highway vehicles. One was, is the planning process correct, and do we have enough enforcement power to enforce the rules that are currently out there for the DNR? And then the second one was to respond to the different stakeholders that did contact our auditors and respond to them how we're going to attack the OHV issue, as we've been working for many years. And I'm not the best person on the OHV issue to ask questions to. Possibly Assistant Commissioner Brad Moore or others could answer this as well.
Assistant Commissioner Moore.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Wiginius, what we're doing is creating an audit team in DNR made up of the different operating divisions. And that audit team's job over the next 7 months is to take a look at every single car, including the OHV cars, and develop a response for how to respond proactively and make the changes necessary in those cars. That audit team is just being formed at the present time, and so we'll be moving forward. So as we go through that process, we can certainly keep you informed exactly what we're doing in that area and in the other areas as well. Because the important thing is that come fall, we have to, where the cars, corrective action requests are there, we have to be able to respond proactively how they were addressed. And if we don't do that, then we run into problems with our certificate.
We risk losing our certificate if we don't respond to these cars.
Representative Gaines?
Of course, I'm thinking of this. You could respond in many ways, and one of the ways you could respond is to say we're going to put in a massive budget request to have many more conservation officers, or you could change the rules of the game and have closed trails instead of open, or closed forests instead of open forests. Do you have any sense of how much of a budget impact your corrective actions will have?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Guineas, we don't yet. We're still in the process of assessing that, and I can tell you State Forester Dave Epperly and I are on the committee that's dealing with that very issue. So that's something that I personally will be involved with, along with the Deputy Commissioner and Commissioner, but we don't know yet.
Commissioner Moore, I was at the press conference when this was announced about the third-party certification, and from what I got from that press conference was that it sounded like they were saying keep up the good work as far as off-road vehicles go. It sounds like we've been moving in the right direction of keeping ATVs and that sort of thing on trails, and I thought we kind of got a pat on the back for that. Did I take that wrong?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think that the certifiers did say we were doing a good job, and I think the key there is in all aspects of forest management, including OHVs, there are always areas we can improve, and we know that. And we're going to continue to move forward.
Very good. Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much, folks. Ms. Thomason, you have a final comment?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to move. I apologize, but I forgot to mention on slide 16, the Blandon Foundation was very instrumental in helping move us forward with the county land forest certification and helping to fund that and bring the groups together, and wanted to just publicly acknowledge them and thank them for that effort as well. So,
very good.
Thank you very much.
We have to move on. We're running short on time, and we have a lot to cover yet. If Mr. Bob Stein would come forward. Private land certification. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Stein. I'm an associate dean at the College of Natural Resources at the University of Minnesota and have responsibilities both in St. Paul and, as some of you know, at the State Forestry Center, so get around the state a lot. I want to start a little bit just about name things. You'll see the title here, Certification of Private Woodlands. You'll hear these lands called Family Forests. You did earlier today sometimes NIPF, Non-Industrial Private Forest Land. We're talking about all the same things, so a variety of names for those kinds of things.
Why is certification important on these lands? The same reasons you heard earlier about state lands and county lands. One is it's an assurance that the lands are being managed sustainably, they're being managed well. Also, the purchasers of wood and paper products from our mills are requiring, demanding in fact, that the products they buy come from certified forests. And so it's important for the private landowners for their land to be certified so that they actually have access to the market. I want to run through just a few facts and explain why this is a little different than state lands and county lands. You've heard 4.8 million acres by one ownership to state, several million acres by sort of a couple handfuls of counties. When we get to state-owned or privately owned land, about 140,000 owners who own 40% of the land, about 6 million acres. And so instead of dealing with one entity like the state of Minnesota to do almost 5 million, we're talking about 140,000 individuals, all with their own interest in their property. Interestingly, they you saw these statistics before, it's maybe down a little bit from 50%, but they're producing at least their share, if not a little more, of the wood that's harvested in Minnesota. So a lot of wood comes from there. About a million acres altogether have stewardship plans now, written plans about what the folks want to do with their property and so forth, and helping them to look forward over time. You heard from Bruce Umballen earlier that enrollment in the Sustainable Forestry Incentives Act is very low, and this has implications around certification because these last two are potentially ways that we can get to these people and help them certify their land through either group certification or by participation in one of these automatically being included. We're not there yet, but that's some of the things that we're working on. Finally, and this is true actually for all owners, there's no financial incentive pushing in certification. At one time, early in the certification, as it first came about, there was a thought that folks like you and me would pay a premium for certified products. It turns out not to be true, and so at least in the forest products industry. And so timber buyers are not able to offer a premium for certified wood, and so for private landowners, there's no financial incentive for them to certify their wood, at least in the marketplace. Some attitudes. The Brandon Foundation was mentioned just a minute ago. They have been very involved in this whole process, provided some funding to the University of Minnesota, one of the researchers there in the College of Natural Resources, to start looking at this issue with private landowners. And this is Dr. Mike Kilgore, the research that he did, and some of this we know from even earlier surveys. Timber production ranks very low on the list of reasons why people own woodlands. Typically it's for recreational purposes or for setting up wildlife habitat, spending time with their families out there, whatever it is. So when we ask them, timber production is fairly far down the list. However, I just showed you the statistics before. We know that in the end, many of these people end up harvesting timber at some point along the way. So even though they don't own it for that, they end up doing that. About a third of the people that we surveyed recently had some interest in certification of their land. About two-thirds are uninterested in certification, which gives us sort of a difficult place to start from. We looked, and there's no obvious demographic reasons that would allow us to predict those who are interested. So we can look at size of ownership, we can look at age, we can look at education, we can look at whether they live there on their land or not. We have not been able to find any patterns that give us a very good hint about what the target group ought to be, at least starting out. And interestingly, in some focus groups, and understand this is on some very small data sets, when we started giving people more information about certification, tended to push them in the direction they were already leaning. And so, coming from the university, we think if we can just educate people, they'll see the light and do it. What we found out in these small groups is that if we tell them more about certifications, those who are not interested, so sets up even more dilemmas for us. So, feels like we're starting from a hole in the ground. Talk a little bit about some of the implications for some of the information that we have already. One, clearly there's no hook for us to get private woodland owners interested in certification. We can't tell them they can make more money by doing it. We just don't know what that hook is, or it's not there. Again, I just mentioned that more information and education doesn't automatically lead to more interest in certification. Conclusion that we have reached, and I'm actually here representing lots of folks, many of who are sitting up here in the seats and others who are interested in this whole idea of certification of private wetlands working is we've all agreed that new approaches are needed. You heard earlier about, on the state having audits and so forth. Those are all expensive. Again, we can't expect folks who own 40 acres or 80 acres or even several hundred acres to pay those kind of costs. So here are some of the approaches that we are looking at. You're going to hear shortly from Dave Chura from the Minnesota Water Education Program about logger certification. And under this approach, loggers would be certified as master loggers, and once they attain that on some level of a size limit on harvesting, that wood would be considered as certified. So really, the landowners don't need to do much other than hire a certified logger. So that's one approach we're looking at. We're also looking at group certification. I mentioned SFIA. Some folks are part of what's called the tree farm system, or if they have stewardship programs. We're trying to identify if there are ways that we can take folks who have already gone through many of the steps required for certification and as a group certify them all. We are spending some time trying to do more thorough owner demographics, trying to figure out if, in fact, we missed something in this first small group, and we can determine that, again, it's either the education level they have or where their land is or how much land they own that helps us identify those who are more likely to be interested in, fact, carry through a certification. We're also looking at their attitudes around certification as well and see if it's simply that they don't understand it, if they view it as, oh, here comes the government, they're going to make me do something, whatever it is, try to figure those kinds of things out. Eventually, we hope we're going to be successful in those previous two and get to the place where we can do some woodland owner education. I am the principal investigator on an LCMR grant on this. We're targeting four counties in north central Minnesota, north central and northeast St. Louis, Itasca, Cass, and Aiken County, and that's where we'll be concentrating these kinds of efforts. We're also trying to look at some statewide or multi-state certification. I mean, we've looked at systems really around the world, and you can go to some countries in the world where all the wood harvested there is considered certified, and that's because they have done it as a country, and so we, as a state, we feel like we need to do that, or in fact maybe join up with some of our neighboring states. Places like Oregon are looking at this, some other states in the country as well. You heard from Bruce Umballen about enhancing SFIA. We're not using LCMR money to do that, but there are, if we can get it to the place where it's more attractive to individuals, and then we can work with certifying agencies to say, if folks are enrolled in SFIA, consider their land certified, that would be good for us. Finally, let me just sort of give you this list of collaborators, really, along with the university. LCMR, again, $376,000 grant we have. Blanton Foundation has put several hundred thousand dollars into this already. You can see the list of other organizations that are there that are all participating, all interested in this being successful. So, Mr. Chair, that concludes my comments. I'd be happy to take questions.
Very good. Any questions for Dean Stein? Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Stein, you indicated that there wasn't any real financial incentive pushing certification, and I can understand that if there isn't, it would be somewhat problematic. But earlier I thought I heard that large purchasers of timber were sort of requiring their buyers or their sellers of the timber to be managing forests properly through certification process. So I'm assuming that these people are selling to some alternate sources, smaller mills or something where they're not requiring to be certified forests?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's a little complicated. The purchasers, we heard Time Inc. Yep. mentioned earlier, and they are requiring that the mills that they buy from have a certain percentage of their wood be certified. There are a variety of mills, and so these folks, in fact, are selling their wood to a variety of places. Typically, an individual landowner will not sell their wood directly to a mill. They will sell it to a logger who then sells it to a variety of mills. They will merchandise that out to a variety of places. The standards that I think the times of the world and others who are demanding this, it's not 100%, and their implementation dates are staggered somewhat, and so we're not at a place yet where all wood or all products that are purchased are required to be certified. It appears that we're going that direction, though. So that's part of the impetus for us to get this moving with the private woodland owners, understanding that they supply 40-50% of the wood in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Representative Hatt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dean Stein, are the woodlands that are being certified, are they primarily northern conifers, or are you seeing some southeastern oak woodlands that are being certified as well?
Yes, fine.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, the small number of private woodlands that are being certified are probably scattered throughout the state. I don't have a specific number about how many private woodlands are actually certified. It'd be a very, very small number. And my guess is that they would be scattered around the state.
Any further questions, Cody? Okay, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Good job. Lodger certification. Executive Director Dave Chura. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Dave Chura, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Logger Education Program. I appreciate the opportunity to provide you with some information and background on logger certification. MLEP is a 501c3 that was established in 1995 to provide assistance to Minnesota's logging community through educational programming. Our membership is comprised of logging businesses and associate members, and we provide training to loggers and natural resource managers in the areas of sustainable forest management, business management, transportation, and safety. As a condition of membership, members must attend 3 days of training on Minnesota's forest management guidelines and the OSHA logging safety standard. Then each year thereafter, their first year, they must maintain 2 days of continuing education on an annual basis. Our members are responsible for more than 95% of the timber that's harvested annually here in this state. As you've heard today, Minnesota is a leader in the United States with its third-party certification of state, county, and industrial forest lands. However, efforts to certify those family forest lands have been far less successful. As Dr. Stein noted, the relatively large number of those landowners and the associated turnover rate of family forest lands, combined with their low level of interest in certification, make them a complicated target for certification efforts. This presents a significant challenge to the forest products industry. As several others have mentioned earlier today, Time Incorporated has asked several mills in Minnesota and across the country to meet a target that 80% of the fiber going into their product be certified by year-end 2006. Often the only forest management advice a landowner receives is from a logger who approaches the landowner to purchase wood. While many loggers are very experienced and have a professional approach to wood procurement, we believe that a well-trained and experienced logger with a broader vision of forestry can provide family forest landowners with sustainable forest management information. As a result, MLEP has developed and is implementing a Minnesota Master Logger Certification Program for Minnesota loggers. Our logger certification program has been endorsed by Time Incorporated as meeting the requirements of their Certified Sustainable Forestry Program. This is a notable achievement. There are only two other state programs in the country that have received this recognition, those states being Maine and Wisconsin. Logger certification has been recognized as a way to independently verify the harvest, safety, and business practices of participant loggers against specific standards. Logger certification provides customers and the general public with assurances that the person or the company performing the job has the training, the education, and the experience to do the job correctly, and that they'll be implementing sustainable practices on the ground. Many of our loggers already meet this standard and criteria that is required for logger certification. However, they don't have a way to authenticate that to others. You can think of logger certification as providing a good housekeeping seal of approval of a logging business's operation. In addition, loggers who become certified are able then to provide certified wood to the marketplace. This means that loggers and mills in Minnesota will be in a strong position to provide certified product to customers like Time Incorporated. MLEP's Minnesota Master Logger Certification Program is comprised of 8 areas of responsibility, including protection of water quality and soils, adherence to site-specific harvest and management plans, and compliance with regulations applicable to logging operations. Each responsibility area has measurable performance standards and practices. A logger seeking certification undergoes an audit of his or her business practices and harvest sites. Independent auditors conduct field audits of the site the applicant has harvested within the last 12 months. Based on their findings, the auditors then make a recommendation for or against certification. We have an 8-member certifying board which represents stakeholders from the broad forestry community, including family forest landowners, the environmental community, and others who review the audits and recommendations and then make a final determination on certification. Once a logger achieves certification, the certification is good for 3 years, and during that time, all of the logger's sites are subject to random review and audit. In just the short time since we began implementing this program in December of 2005, we have more than 20 logging businesses that have applied for certification and that are currently completing the business management portion of the audits. Our auditor training is scheduled for March 23rd and 24th, and we expect that there will be a formal certification and recognition taking place in June of this year. In summary, logger certification provides loggers in Minnesota the opportunity to become certified by independent third-party auditors, and it increases the amount of third-party certified wood in the marketplace. Overall, we believe logger certification will raise the bar of logging in Minnesota in terms of safety and on-the-ground application of forest management guidelines. Again, thank you for the opportunity to provide you with some information on logger certification, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions for Mr. Churro? Representative Dill, you got any questions for your constituent?
No, I sure know, but he's a good constituent. Glad to have him.
Any further questions? Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On your certification, you mentioned it's a performance-based program. Is there a competency measurement as well, or is it looking at practices? Is there a test involved or in the certification?
The test certainly is the audits that take place, taking a look at, they do a minimum of 3 audits the first year, taking a look at specific field activities that have taken place. And so they go out, the standard is about an 8-to-10-page document, and the auditors look for very specific things based on Minnesota Forest Management guidelines to see if they are, in fact, implementing those things on the site. If they are, they need to pass a certain number of performance practices before they can pass a performance area. You need to pass a certain number of performance areas to pass an area, and you need to pass all 8 areas of the standard in order to become certified.
Mr. Chair, if during that 3-year period, if there's an audit and you discover something that's wrong that jeopardizes certification or there's a loss of certification, what are the consequences? Certification is pulled or the logger is put on probation or they're prohibited from getting certification renewed? What are the consequences for a bad action?
Mr. Chairman, Representative. There are procedures in place to deal with probation and removal from the program, just as you would find in other certification programs.
Okay. Further questions, Representative Bill?
I do have a question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, how many people have the audit done and don't make the cut as a percentage? Loggers, meaning how many loggers?
Well, in Minnesota, this is our first go-through. So we've got 20 folks that are applying for certification, and we would hope that all of them become certified. It's my understanding that in Wisconsin and Maine, states that have gone through this before, not all folks have become certified. Some have withdrawn from the process before the final determination is made, and others just simply didn't meet the standard.
Representative Bill?
So I take from that answer that in general, that prior to the certification program that people were getting their act together on doing it the right way.
I think if you take a look at Mr. Chairman, Representative, if you take a look at the monitoring that's been done in this state, the implementation of the guidelines by loggers, voluntary guidelines, is impressively high.
Thank you.
Very good. Any further questions? Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Next, we'll talk on Forest Legacy Program, Mr. Ron Nagin. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
For the record, my name is Ron Nargang. I'm the State Director for the Nature Conservancy. Is this gone? thing. There we go. Mr. Chairman, members, I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today about an issue that most of you have probably seen some exposure on through the various media coverages from the Star Tribune and Duluth Tribune, and maybe you pick up the Department of Natural Resources volunteer. We have a group of lands in this state that we're very concerned about the future of. And those are the large block industrial forest lands in northern Minnesota. There is sort of a perfect storm that has begun to assault these lands. It started on the East Coast and has slowly marched across the northern tier of the country and is in Minnesota. And I think what got everyone's attention about the seriousness of this was the sale of the Boise Cascade Mill and over 2 million acres of land to Madison Dearborn almost a year ago at this time. And then within 6 weeks, all of the land had been resold to a TIMO, a Timber Investment Management Organization, and you've mentioned them earlier today, Forest Capital Partners. To see that volume of land change hands that quickly is alarming enough in itself, but we have to recognize that that kind of a change in ownership changes the game on management strategies for that land. When our paper companies owned those lands, they planned on a 100-year time frame. They wanted those lands available, producing wood and fiber to fuel their mills. When a TIMO takes control of them, the planning time frame shortens to 10 years, and they look to maximize the profit from those lands, and they will log them heavily, and then they will parcelize them into 20- and 40-acre parcels, and we will see the character and fabric of the Northwood changed in some fairly dramatic ways. We've got 1 million acres of these lands in play in Minnesota right now, 300,000 in the old Boise lands. Potlatch is the largest private owner at nearly 400,000. We've got UPM Kimony, the old Land and Paper Company, with 175,000 acres, and then it trickles down from there. But let me take you to a map to show you where those lands are distributed. And talk a little more about the storm that's hitting these lands. First off, you heard earlier in the testimony about the global competition. These companies are waiting in a global marketplace where the profit margins are ever thinner. Oftentimes they'll find they can buy eucalyptus pulp from Ecuador cheaper than they can produce it on lands in Minnesota because they can raise it in a two-year rotation in the tropics. Secondly, they're Wall Street bankers are looking very closely at their portfolios, and they are looking at these land assets as underperforming assets. They've owned them for 100 years. Their basis in the properties is almost non-existent, and they're being pressed heavily to capitalize those assets to improve the bottom line. And then we've got a change in social attitudes in this state. If any of us had thought about buying land up north, 10 or 15 years ago, it probably would have had to have water in front of it in order for it to be attractive. We aren't making any more of that, and the prices of it have gone so high that it's out of reach for many people, and the social attitude shift that's taken place here is to make it acceptable to just have a place in the woods, if you will. Folks will hook onto the boat trailer and trailer to the water. And so we are seeing increasing development causing serious fragmentation in northern forests, and we think that we've got to do something to prevent that from happening to these large block forest lands. And we think it's important because, number one, we need these lands to continue to provide wood and fiber for a very important industry in this state. Secondly, if you talk to many Minnesotans, they have viewed these lands as public lands. They've been wide open for outdoor recreation. There are snowmobile trails running through them. They're used as hunting sites. We're going to see conflict in the countryside if these are parcelized and the no trespassing signs start going up. It's going to be a shock to folks who have used these lands for the last 20, 25, 30 years. And These lands are critical to the fabric of the forest. This is, if you can see it, the white blocks in here are primarily all Boise Cascade lands mixed in with the green blocks of public land. Now, if you just envision for a moment houses beginning to spring up on those white blocks, roads being driven into them, we're really ripping the fabric of that integrated forest.
And we should not let that happen for all kinds of reasons. I think that it's been very encouraging as we've talked about this to hear local governments recognize that if that kind of fragmentation occurs, their cost of delivery of services just soars because there's got to be roads put in, you have to run school buses, you have to provide police and fire protection. Give you another example here from Itasca County. The crosshatched piece that you see is a combination of UPM Kimmery Lands and the Rila family's holdings, Rila Lumber. And you'll note how they are the connecting piece between two large blocks of state and federal forest land. This is a classic migration corridor. These are the kinds of places that are very important for large mammals like moose that require a large territory to roam through. It's the adjacency issue that makes many of these blocks absolutely essential to be protected. And I want to emphasize that not all of the million acres needs to be protected. There are many of those acres that are already roaded or are adjacent to roads. We have the Natural Resource Research Institute under contract right now to do a prioritization process to identify for us where the large interior blocks are and identify the others that are very appropriate for sale and subdivision development. So I want to emphasize that this is not about keeping people from enjoying and living in the woods. It's about where it's done and how it's done. And in order to respond to this, we have developed a partnership focusing on the greater Itasca County area. We picked Itasca County because that county has the highest concentrations of these industry lands of any county in the state. It's not the only place that exists, but the highest concentration is there. And we formed the partnership that you see on the screen. The Blandon Foundation has seen the wisdom of trying to protect these large block forests. They have given us a challenge grant of $6.25 million. For the purpose of purchasing forest legacy easements on these lands. Our commitment to the foundation is to turn that $6 million into $26 million, an additional $6 in private funds and the balance in public monies from state and United States Congress. I get the question immediately from folks, how many acres will that be? And I can't give you an absolute answer because it depends on the lands that are brought to the table. If I know who the landowner is and where the proposed lands are, we'll be able to figure that out. But it's very different in cost depending on whether it's old Boise lands that are Spruce Bay lands or whether we get proposals like the Rila proposal that we have on the table now, which is mature hardwood forest in the Sugar Hills area south of Grand Rapids. The value of those lands varies widely, and so we think we can do anywhere from 30,000 to 75,000 acres, and we would hope that is not an end game, that is a start, and that we can demonstrate how well this works and begin to tackle the much larger job that exists here. I'll end my comments with that, Mr. Chairman. Some of you have already signed on to the bill. We appreciate that, and if others are interested, we'd be happy to talk to you about it. But we think it's an important thing to do.
Very, very good. Thank you. Representative Bill.
Thank you, Chair Hardware. What is going to happen when these easements are put on the land? What will happen to the value, underlying value, and how the taxes that are paid on that property flow to the... Particularly, I'm worried about county governments, you know, Itasca County, St. Louis County, Couchiching County, you know, vast holdings of forest capital and all the other industrial landowners. I'm worried about the counties here.
Mr. Nargang?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, great question. The way this works is that an appraiser is hired. They go out and appraise the land at its highest and best use, and that gives them one value. Then they take the easement restrictions that will be placed on the land and they do a second appraisal based on those restrictions, and the difference is what the value of that easement is and what establishes our value of purchase from the seller. We've looked closely at the issue of impact on property taxes, and we're not finding that easements are having significant negative impacts on property tax revenue to local units of government. And we've talked with local governments in the Itasca County area. We've got a resolution of support from the Chamber of Commerce up there and many other groups in the area. I don't expect this to be detrimental to the county's economic situation, and I think what they're seeing is that if it goes the other way, and the development occurs, the cost of delivery of services is going to overwhelm any negative impact on the tax base for the county.
Thank you.
Representative Magmar.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Nargang,
My question is, you know what, Mr. Chair, I completely spaced it out. You'll have to let Representative Pennis go. I'm losing it today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Who would hold these easements? They're perpetual, right? But who holds them? The state of Minnesota or?
Ms. Nardi.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the easements will be held by the Department of Natural Resources, the state of Minnesota, and they will administer.
Representative?
Oh, that's
a geography,
but that's fine.
Yeah, I got it. You know, it's tough getting old. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Narangig, there's a possibility that we could get some LTMR money potentially that would be able to supplement this. I know Chairman Tinglestad is working on a couple of things. How soon are you able to use this money if, for instance, something like that was to happen and to actually expand on the potential $26 million? Would you be able to find additional easements above and beyond the $26 million, and potentially are some of those available very soon?
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, yes, we've got active applications in Minnesota. You know, this isn't new to Minnesota. It's been happening. You appropriated some bonding money for it a year ago that went to easement with Potlatch in the Brainerd Lakes area. There are three active applications in Minnesota right now. One is from the Itasca County area. That's the Rila family, Lula Lumber. There is a second one in southeast Minnesota, I believe Winona County. That is a cluster of 14 or 15 private landowners. And then there's another proposal in the Brainerd Lakes area with Potlatch that are active. And we're in active discussions with the other large owners, Forest Capital Partners, Potlatch. And we've had an ongoing discussion with UPM Kimini. I believe they're just waiting to see how the permitting process for their new paper machine goes before we can get a little more direct about that one. So I think we can use it on a short-term basis.
Yeah. Representative Dale?
Well, this isn't really a question, Mr. Chairman. It's more of something for the committee. Minnesota, I think, is in what may be the last great land rush. It's just overwhelming the amount of activity that's occurring on lands in these remote rural communities. And as an example, I'm participating in it. I've seen it coming for a few years. I saw a chance to buy 160 acres. Had to pay $1,000 an acre for it. There's not a tree on it. I mean, 1990, maybe a little earlier than that, you could have bought a 40 at the same place for $5,000 for 40 acres. I mean, it's just, it's exponentially going up the value with or without trees. And I'm also just completely shocked by the number of no trespassing signs that are now in my district. It's just overwhelming to drive down roads that I've been driving my entire life since I was a youth, and that what lands that I thought, and even since I've been elected as a state representative, I thought were industrial lands or quasi-public lands, that's what I call those, or property that is owned by the state or a county or a school district, to suddenly see no trespassing signs and to see culverts along a road where you'd never saw a single culvert before in a little woods road leading back out of sight. And then when I fly over it in my airplane, I see a cabin in the woods. And I can't even begin to explain to you, having one of the most rural wilderness setting type areas where a tremendous amount of the wood it comes from, how staggering of a problem this is. And I'm pretty protective of private property rights in general. But these easement things seem to be a pretty good extension of what we need to do to protect lands that we can get to keep it in that type of setting. I'd invite anyone to come and experience it.
Representative Horton?
You had mentioned a bill. I hadn't heard anything about the bill that you were talking about. Can you explain what it is?
Mr. Chairman,
tell us who the author of the bill is and a little bit about the bill.
We've got a bill in for the $10 million bonding for the Forest Legacy Partnership to get some additional attention to the issue. And I can give you the list. I handed my list off to one of the staff back there that's got the list of authors on it, but I know Representative McNamara is on there. Representative Tinglestad is signed on to it. And I don't know if we have anybody else at the table right now, but I think Representative Osment is also on the bill. Mm-hmm. Would normally be at the committee. But that's what it's about.
Representative McNamara?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's Representative Howes, I believe, is the chief author, if anybody. And it might have gone in today. I'm not sure.
Representative Wiginia.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Yarganic, Representative Pennis asked if these were permanent easements, and I didn't hear a direct answer to that question. Are they permanent easements?
Representative Wiginia, I'm sorry, maybe I didn't respond to it. They are perpetual easements. Yes.
Perpetual easements. Yes. And the governor has agreed to this?
Yes.
You also mentioned that what you are asking for is just the beginning of something that needs to be done. We're looking at 30 to 75,000 acres. What are you projecting at this point in terms of acreage and in terms of dollars that you're going to be asking for this particular endeavor?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wiginia, I'm hesitant to answer that until NRI is done with this prioritization thing. I think if you think back to that map that I had up there, and I can get it back up in front of you, and look where the large, bold blocks are, those are the places where we really ought to put our highest priority on it, particularly where they're embedded right in with public lands. I don't know what that number is going to look like. I would say at least half of these acres probably fall into that category. But the other opportunity that's here, short of an easement, is once we get engaged in discussions, there are other tools. Land exchanges would be a wonderful way to resolve this problem and identify isolated state parcels that would be appropriate to move off the state portfolio and exchange them for holes in the donut with these private owners where there is a piece of industry land embedded in a piece of public land. That changes the whole game on the cost of this if we can do some large-scale land exchanges. And I'm not ready to put a dollar estimate on it, but it's going to cost a lot of money.
Mr. Chairman, I think we do have to have a dollar estimate. We're saying, well, this is a little piece to go forward if we're going to do this strategy. I think what I hear you talking about is 500,000 acres, if it's half of the million. So it's 500,000 acres. And if we know that, what do you think we're talking about in terms of dollar? Give me a range, not a figure.
Ms. Nargan?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Virginius, I could see this turning into a $100 to $200 million program over a period of 10 to 15 years fairly easily. Once again, it varies dramatically depending on the lands that we're talking about. If you look at Couchiching County, a lot of the lands that Boise Cascade owned there are pretty inaccessible. The price on those goes way down, and we ought to probably also address the question of whether we need to buy easements on them in order to protect them because of the lack of accessibility. But again, that's what we're trying to get at through this prioritization process.
Okay, Representative Pennis.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to make it, I know it was brought up by Representative Dill and a very valid point, and I don't disagree with it. However, we must remember that when we come down here also, we see expansion going on. And with the number of people coming to the state each year and having to have places to live and so on, it just keeps going out and out and out. And I don't even question that they have, and nor have I challenged that they have a no trespassing sign up. But I will.
Representative
Dill. Well, Mr. Chairman, to that point, Representative Pennis, I would just love to see another 1.2 million acres of wilderness in the 7 or 8 or 10 county metro area. just a wonderful thing. You know, we happen to have that up where I live, and I think it would, it's very appropriate here, I mean, considering the situation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, on that point, in Dakota County, we did vote to raise our taxes to purchase farmland and natural areas to protect them from development and do purchase of development rights. And so, and I know that Washington County will be looking at it again this fall. So I think, you know, the point I was going to ask Mr. Nargang is, we heard from Dr. Stein earlier that education doesn't necessarily work, that the models that we've used for 20 years of trying to teach people, either we do training or we hand out brochures, and you've been a part of this, you know, it's down to the dollar now, and that we can't, in some of the counties, there's a tremendous amount of public land, we can't afford to purchase all the land, and so the tools that we have, it appears that the easement is the tool that we have, and that I just like your experience and perspective on that, because if we have limited state dollars, where do we go? I mean, if it's a question of money going into brochures or training, or is it money that goes into an easement? Or on the easements, should we also target those to riparian areas or along waterways via the Clean Water Legacy? You know, do we start to get a multiplier effect here for multiple other purposes? Mr. Nargang, you have a lot of experience here, and I'd like your input on that question.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, you asked a very wide-ranging question there. But if we're talking specifically about the North Woods, I agree wholeheartedly that it's not about ownership of the fee title in the land. You only have to look at this map behind me to know that it's, number one, going to be very controversial to acquire any additional public land up there. But we ought to recognize that it's about how the land is managed and how the forest is managed. And it doesn't have to be in public ownership to be healthy. You heard a whole series of things stacked one on top of another here that are improving the quality and character of our forest, whether it's certification, excuse me, better educated loggers. Those things are all beginning to make a difference. And they're all getting folded into a long-term vision created by the State Forest Resources Council through its landscape planning efforts. People that live and work in those landscapes have described a desired future condition, and using all of these tools that you've heard about, we can move the forest toward those desired future conditions. Easements are part of this. They're an extremely flexible tool, and I think we ought to use them to the maximum degree possible. My organization has built its reputation on buying land, but in northeast Minnesota, we are not pursuing that as a course of action. We've bought a couple of places up there to get a spot at the table with the adjacent landowners, and then we're talking to them about collaborative forest management. And instead of doing forest management in 40-acre blocks based on ownership, if we need X number of cords to come out of the woods, let's get the owners together and let's shape a harvest that follows what would be a more natural disturbance line in the forest so that we don't have a checkerboard pattern. Species will respond to that, both the tree species and migratory neotropical birds that like those varied edges within the forest. So it's very much about how we manage the land. It's not about who holds the fee title to it, and those easements are a fabulous tool to get there.
Okay, Representative Corning. Mr. Chair, Mr. Nargang, is there anybody else that would be logical to handle these easements? I mean, isn't the DNR or the state a logical organization to pick? I mean, who else, whether in the private sector or public sector or state, is going to take charge of these easements once they're purchased? I mean, you're kind of reined into the state, aren't you? I mean, has anybody else volunteered to handle the program?
Ms. Nargang?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cornish, you know, there are a lot of folks in the state that handle easements. My organization holds a number of easements. The Minnesota Land Trust has become kind of the easement specialist in the state and in the private sector. The Trust for Public Land would be another logical candidate for that. But I think in this case, it's just almost a no-brainer to have the Department of Natural Resources do this, and that is the pattern under the Federal Forest Legacy Program, is that the state agency responsible takes and holds the easements.
Representative.
And this is a sincere question, Mr. Chair. And will you tell me then what you are buying when you buy that land? I mean, the easement is being held by, let's just say, the state. And so you're buying something, but it's very prescriptive. So then, and again, I refer to Representative Dill serving on the IRRB with you. You have to have, for people to stay there and for to contribute to your county and, you know, be a part of the mix, you have to have economic development in that area. Now, you're buying a piece of land, but what do you have left for rights on that land? I mean, I don't think we have a lot now, but what would you have left then?
Is that for Representative Dill? Or?
No, it's for anybody that can answer it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pence, typically the way you hear this described is that interest in lands is like a bundle of sticks in your hand. And with an easement, what you are doing is you are purchasing those sticks one at a time, and you define in the easement which sticks you're taking out of the bundle. In this case, we would buy the stick that says we're going to have continued public access to the land for recreational purposes. We would specify in the easement that the land has to remain in forest production, so it's got to be working forest land. Wooden fiber has to continue to come off of it. It would further specify that forest management has to be done in a sustainable manner. So all of the things you heard about earlier in the testimony that amount to sustainable forest management would be required on these lands. It's a great way to get at an owner like Forest Capital Partners that is not currently certified, but would manage under essentially the same standards of certification if they went under this easement. So in each case, we'll negotiate what portion of that bundle of sticks will be purchased under the easement, and it will be carefully enunciated in that easement.
And one last question. What stick do you see the owner having left? Well, besides the deed.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pence, they will hold a lot of the sticks. They will be the ones that are actively managing the land. They will make decisions on what the cash flow from the property will be in which year, as long as they're managing within the framework of the plan. That's correct.
Further questions, Ms. Maggie?
If I can, I'll give staff some brief fact sheets on this if people would like to have something to carry away. And I think Mr. Moore may just have a wrap-up comment.
Well, I would like to have Mr. Moore come forward and just kind of wrap things up.
Thank you,
Ms. Nardine. Mr. Moore, if you do have any final comments, I'd appreciate that. The public access issue seems to be one of the interests me. And when we say that public access would be required when we get into these this legacy program, what do we mean by that? Do we know, or is that written in statute somewhere, or where is it written that what that means?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the Commissioner's Office of DNR, Gene Merriam, Mark Holston, and I, that's a requirement we put on it. And so in terms of the bonding dollars that we are seeking, the $10 million, we've made it clear with our partners and also the folks that we've been starting to negotiate with that we must have public access. We're not interested in using those dollars where the public doesn't have that access. And that access can include, you know, a variety of uses. For example, on some of the easements, there are snowmobile trails that go through those and other roads that need to remain open, and that's all part of the negotiation process. I'm not aware of anything in the statutes or law that require it, Mr. Chairman.
Very good. We'll take one more question from Representative Rodinius, and then we're going to have some announcements. So, Representative Rodinius, final question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would assume that when you're talking about public access, then one of the accesses for HOVs.
Pardon me, is for?
Offering vehicles.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rodinius, that is one of the issues that is negotiated out. So, for example, in Rila properties, which the negotiations are underway, the primary use on that property are cross-country ski trails. Lila isn't interested in ATV use there, and they currently don't have ATV use on their lands. So on that one, the negotiation concerns a snowmobile trail that crosses their lands that the department is very interested in having it maintained. So it's easement by easement.
Anything further, Representative Guinness?
Easement by easement. Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'd like to thank everybody that participated today and came and gave testimony. Members, we had this informational hearing today because, as you know, we're going to be through the policy committee and we're going to be right up against deadlines very, very soon. So we thought we'd bring some folks in and talk about some forestry issues so we don't have to rehash this during session. Next Tuesday, we're going to have another hearing on some mercury issues that have to do with electric generation and mercury and those kinds of things. So that will be next Tuesday at 12:30. Room 200, the same room, we think. Also, members, you seen that we had one of our testifiers today was Mr. Dave Trill. He was my first committee administrator of this committee, and he's moved on to what he might think is better, bigger and better things. We also have Mr. Josh Gackle back with us. He was gone for a short time. Mr. Jake Hamlin, he has left for also bigger and better things, I think. And we're lucky enough to get Mr. Josh Gackle back, and I very much appreciate having him back. So a warm round of applause for Mr. Gackle. With that, members, please don't forget to turn in your per diem slips and meeting adjourned.